A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete!
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Okay, everybody, welcome to the Comedians of Law podcast. This is Alex Barnett.
This is Kevin Israel.
Yeah, we're joined by Kevin in the booth today, and this is episode 67 of the podcast. Very exciting post-New Year, first episode of 2014 podcast episode.
Kicking it off big with Kevin and Alex.
That's right. We got a couple of really big news stories today, some really interesting ones, and some big news about what we'll be doing performance-wise, live performance-wise in 2014, in January, in just a few short weeks. Kev, we've got, well, you have a really big event coming up on the 16th.
Yes. We're going to be at the Crossroads in Garwood, New Jersey. They got a little comedy club going on in the bar there, and we work with some of the comics there. So Joan, Nadidi, and I will be at Crossroads. It's going to be at 8 o'clock. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can go to you can actually find us at you can buy tickets at www.eventbrite.com / comedians at law at crossroads crossroads-tickets, and you can get tickets there. If you go to Eventbrite and you just search comedians at law, you'll find us. It's 8 o'clock show, and it's gonna be a really good time. We're expecting a good crowd. It's a cool little room, very intimate. So hopefully going to be some good stuff.
Right. And then, on the other side of the country, same month, our two Matts, Matt Ritter and Matt Storrs, along with John W. Goldstein, will be in Arizona for two big shows, the Tempe Improv on January 29th at 8 p.m. and the Stand Up Live Comedy Theater on January 30th at 8 p.m. And I believe that second one is in, Phoenix.
We're taking over the country.
We are. And in fact, I will be, this is a private event, but I will be down in Augusta, Georgia on the 16th performing for the Augusta Bar. And actually, you and Matt will be at Vanderbilt Law School.
Yeah, so, January is big for us.
Yeah. So, and our February calendar is starting to fill up too. So if people want to book us for their events or perform at a club in their community, they should contact us right away, either by email at info@comediansatlaw.com. Or on Twitter at Comedians of Law.
Yeah, just tweet us. It's easy.
Yeah. So, well, those are the things we've got coming up, and of course, it's a very exciting new year for us, and we're looking.
How was your New Year's? Did you do anything fun?
Did I do anything fun?
I'm guessing no.
Well, I am married and have a child, so that the answer would be no. But I did get to watch a good movie. And stay in on amateur night. So yes, that was pretty fun. What about you?
What movie did you? Was it a Technicolor? Was it a full color movie?
It was a full color movie. I can't remember which one it was because
it must have been awesome.
It was great.
You don't remember what movie it was?
No, I have no idea. It was 4 days ago. What do you want to talk about?
I've recently seen. I saw Wolf of Wall Street and I saw American Hustle.
Are they any good?
Yes, they were both very good.
Okay. I'm sure you like Wolf of Wall Street. There's a lot of sex and nudity in that one.
You know what? I did not know there was going to be as much sex and nudity in Wolf of Wall Street as there was. It was kind of surprising. I could draw Leo DiCaprio's ass at this point.
Well, that's something. Yeah. So, all right. Well, did you have a good New Year's, though? Good New Year's Eve.
Yeah, I went to a party with some folks that I work with. The party ended up being full of a lot younger people than I am, so that was weird. But I was actually pretty low key, and I didn't do nothing overly exciting happened. So it was a pretty quiet entree into 2014.
All right, we'll see. It wasn't that much different than mine. Just you went out.
No, it was a little different.
All right. All right. Well, in any event, let's get forward into the news. We've got a lot of big news stories. We gotta hustle through this. We got a lot of things going on. So, without any further delay, here is the news.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
So, Kev, our first story. This is a really interesting one. This is right up your alley because you're sort of a sci-fi fantasy geek.
Yes.
It turns out that some North Carolina town councilman decided to tender his resignation in Klingon.
Yeah, this, and I like this story for two reasons. Number one, obviously, he wrote out a resignation and he wrote it in Klingon, which is apparently a complete language that people know. If you don't know what a Klingon is one of the typical villainous races in Star Trek. It's a Star Trek thing, very big into Trekkies. And they've somehow, I don't know if Gene Roddenberry was involved in it or if it was a fan thing, but they did create an entire language for Klingons. And this councilman, David Waddell, from North Carolina, he like you said, he gave his resignation in written completely in Klingon, which I really like. But what I like even more is why he resigned. He resigned because he's a fiscal conservative and he felt that they were spending too much money, the council, and all his votes were just meaningless. And he decided that it was pointless to stay on the council. And so he resigned, and he resigned in Klingon. And he ended it with his own version of the Klingon battle cry. He said, "Perhaps today is a good day to resign," which I think typically the saying is, "Perhaps today is a good day to die." So he with a little bit of drama, he stepped out of the political spotlight.
Right. Although, just to step right back into it, because apparently he's now going to challenge Kay Hagan, who's a Democrat, for her Senate seat.
I hope he does. I hope he has like a campaign commercial where he speaks only in Klingon.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting. Certainly, he's running as a write-in candidate of the Constitution Party, though he admits that he is a long shot to win. But who knows? I mean, he might capture the popular attention.
Yeah, and with all of this media coverage he's getting because of his Klingon, who knows? I really want more people to start popping up and writing resignations in weird. Like, I want somebody to do something in Elvish. You know, just maybe this could create a whole trend of nonsense out there that, you know, sci-fi fantasy people could start writing in Orcish.
Well,
you know.
Well, here's a question though, in semi-seriously, is that since we're a legal podcast of sorts, and we need to look at, I guess, legal aspects of news, even if it is in a humorous way. here's the legal question. If you tender your resignation in a language that's not English, is it an official resignation?
Jesus, Alex. I mean, come on.
Right?
I feel like I'm in contracts class. It's just one of those obnoxious that person in the back of the room raises their hand and asks the ridiculous hypo that nobody wants to answer.
Well, because you don't know the answer. That's just because you don't know the answer doesn't mean you get a bad question.
I disagree. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, who knows? I don't know that it has to be. I'm guessing that there probably was an actual English written version of this.
Or to take it in a different direction, should he be subject to a contempt proceeding by the body in which he sat for sort of mocking this sobriety and somber tone of the town council?
Well, I think the loose purse strings that the council seems to work with are contempt itself.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they should have a little bit of fiscal constraint.
Spoken like a true Republican. So obviously I'm sort of joking, but I guess the question is, you know, in some seriousness, if make it a more realistic example, if somebody were sitting in a town council, let's say, and they resigned in French, for example, which is obviously a recognized language of Earth,
unfortunately,
but not, you know, typically used in the United States. You know, would that be official? And I think the answer would be yes. I mean, people are, for the same reason that this guy's Klingon resignation should be accepted, but it does also.
Yeah, well, I think also if you tendered your resignation in an actual language. And then they attempted to say that it you know, it was void. I think that there could be a discrimination issue there.
Maybe.
Here, Klingon is not only not of Earth, it's not of reality, because Klingons, as far as we know, don't exist.
Right.
So you really can't discriminate against the Klingon race. But if you do, there would probably be an intergalactic war that would cause some problems.
Right. But I think actually this points to in a different direction, something that this guy didn't do, but is often in the news from time to time. You know, how people are trying to make English the official language of the United States, and that you must speak English because I guess some people are unhappy about the influx of immigrants who are speaking Spanish or Chinese or Korean or what have you. And, you know, those efforts have been knocked down time and time again, but people keep bringing them up. And I guess so now the question is, you know, should we have official language legislation?
Absolutely, and it should be Klingon. Klingon should be the official American language. Okay. It started here. Alex Barnett said it. This is going to be our new standard. We're going to push the Klingon language movement.
Well, you know that in Manhattan, there'll be the Klingon language school. It'll be very elitist. It'll be very hard to get into.
Everybody's going to be trying to get their kids in there, and there's going to be a whole system to try to weasel your little kid in so he can speak the best Klingon. I don't know. Do you think there should be a national language?
No, absolutely not.
You don't think there's any value to that?
I think that you know, this is one place where I think I adopt the theories of your party, which is, you know, sort of a market-based theory. In other words, you know, English is widely used throughout the country because that is the language of commerce. That is the thing that allows you to operate in society most efficiently and easily and make the most money and be the most successful and have the most prosperity. And in fact, even though English is not the official language of the United States or, in fact, the world, we know that English is now used, I think, by some ridiculous number, like 50% or 80% of the world speaks English. So, and there's no legislation requiring that. I think you allow people to use the language that allows them to operate in the world, and by force or persuasion, it'll lead them to English. You know, if somebody wants to speak Italian at home or Italian in their community, why should I stop them?
Oh yeah, I'm not saying that we should walk around knocking on people's doors asking if they speak any other language. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of argument out there that having to translate things into multiple languages is expensive. It delays, like you said, it's a commerce issue. It can delay commerce. It creates some confusion. Maybe there's a cohesiveness. I actually don't have a position on this. It's never been an issue for me. I've never encountered something where I was like, wow, I really wish this guy spoke. Other than when I call customer helplines, but I don't really think that's an American issue.
Right. I mean, I just don't see the point. I think the answer is people make this argument like, oh, it costs money because the government has to translate all the official forms into Spanish and Arabic and Chinese and Urdu and whatever else. And my response would be, well, look, America has always been a country of immigrants from the beginning of time. We're a better country because we have immigration. And if the price of that, or one of the prices of it, is that we have to translate some forms into other languages, ultimately over time, the return on investment will be much higher because we're getting people who want to be here, who are entrepreneurial and hungry to be successful. And they're going to start using English once they're here because that's the way you get ahead here. And right. I think, you know, it's nothing comes for free. And if you want to be a country of immigrants that succeeds because of importing smart, successful, hungry people, you have to pay a little bit of a price. And the price is, you know, maybe you have to translate, you know, taxes into Spanish.
Right. I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you. And I think this transfers us really well into our next topic.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Of immigration. So why don't you take the intro on this, because this was a story that you found.
Yeah, well, this is fascinating. So in California, which is often on the cutting edge of liberal policy, a Mexican immigrant, the court out there, state Supreme Court, ruled unanimously that a man named Sergio Garcia, who is an immigrant without a green card, and he passed the bar exam, he is allowed to practice law in California. And that's an issue because, obviously, without a green card and he's not a citizen, he's not a legal immigrant or a citizen. And so the question is, should he be licensed to practice law, which is basically being an officer of the court, somebody who's entitled to enforce and prosecute the laws of the United States? And the court said, well, look, and this is quoting, they said, the fact that an undocumented immigrant's presence in this country violates federal statutes is not itself a sufficient or persuasive basis for denying undocumented immigrants as a class admission to the state bar, end quote. So this falls right into the strike zone of the gigantic immigration debate we're having in this country. Because
right.
the question always is, well, what rights do immigrants have or should they have?
Right. And obviously the issue here is that he is allowed to become a lawyer and practice law, but he is apparently not. He can't get a job. Which
right.
Which, right. you know, which is probably what most of the law students are feeling the pain of right now. They can all graduate and they can practice law, but probably pass the bar. But there are no jobs out there. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners can sympathize with this guy. But the problem is that he's actually legally barred from being hired. Or anyway, firms are legally barred from hiring him.
Well, you raise an interesting point because, right, firms would be barred from hiring him by law because he can't, you know, provide certain documentation. But the interesting thing is if he wanted to hang out a shingle and practice as a solo, there are other barriers to entry just to doing that because, for example, he can't register with the state or with the federal government as a business. He can't incorporate
right.
himself. He probably, right. I would assume, can't get legal malpractice insurance because he isn't a licensed business. It probably would be very difficult to get legitimate office space, right? Because how do you get a lease? So even if he wanted to be a solo practitioner representing, let's say, other immigrants with their immigration issues, how does he operate? He operates presumably in the margins of society, like a back alley lawyer or something like that.
Yeah, well, and you know, and it's in the decision they went on because the court addressed this issue of the fact that he can't be hired anywhere, and the court, as so many legal rulings are, vaguely answered it by saying, we assume that a licensed undocumented immigrant will make all necessary inquiries and take appropriate steps to comply with applicable legal restrictions and will advise potential clients of any possible adverse or limiting effect the attorney's immigration status may pose. Which right. is basically, they punted. They punted that issue. And you didn't even have to be in law school to have read legal decisions before, but that was 50 words that says absolutely nothing.
Right.
And, clearly the court just didn't want to address that because if they did, they would really be taking on that immigrant issue that we're talking about.
Well, here's the question. Do you think they made the right ruling in the first instance? Do you think they were correct in giving him the right to be a licensed attorney?
Yeah. You know, the whole – for me and you know, my party, as you like to say, I probably go against what my party would say, but – at least the national party position. We can't stop people from coming into this country. Like we said on the last story, we're a country of immigrants. My family were immigrants. Your family were immigrants at some point. We were all immigrants. Unless you were a Native American, you were an immigrant at some point.
Absolutely.
So how do we now suddenly just drop the bar and say no more immigrants? That goes completely contrary to the.
Well, all right, but and I'm with you, but let me make the other argument, which is okay, that's all well and good, but you know your family, my family, other families came here through legal channels. They got on a boat, they got on a plane, whatever it was, they came here, they registered with the authorities, they either got citizenship or they filed paperwork and got green cards. This is a guy who isn't a citizen, he doesn't have a green card, he is quote unquote an illegal alien. Should he have the right to get a privilege of society, which is to be licensed as an attorney?
Yes, I think so, because the we're creating a greater detriment on society by not permitting illegal immigrants to work legally. They're not paying taxes, number one, which is a huge thing.
I thought you guys hate tax.
What's that?
I thought you guys hate taxes.
I hate taxes, but if we all have to pay them, everybody should be paying them. It should go across the board.
Fair enough.
A lot of times they can't get health insurance. So when they get sick, that becomes a burden on the rest of us. And you know, they're not contributing as this guy obviously could. This guy was very intelligent. He was an honor student, you know, in college and in law school. He passed the California bar, which is known to be the hardest bar exam in the country, on the first shot. He could be probably making a lot of money, and really be contributing to the economy. But now, you know, because of the rules in the country and the way things work, he's struggling. And I think we're doing our country and our communities more harm than good by worrying so much about what to do with these people than just by easing the process. And you're right, our ancestors did come here legally, but at that time it was so much easier to become a citizen than it is now.
Well,
and
maybe
there weren't
yes,
nearly
maybe
the
no, but maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. But the answer is, I think you really put your finger on it, which is the country needs to kind of almost revolutionize the way it looks at immigration, which is it shouldn't matter how you got here. It should matter how committed you are to staying here. And if you really want to stay here, then we should make it relatively barrier-free to become a citizen or a documented worker. You know, maybe getting it to be a citizen is difficult because you have to pass certain tests and show your allegiance to the country and whatever, whatever. But if you can show that you have a way of gaining gainful employment, which this guy as an attorney does, although these days most attorneys can't show that they can get gainful employment, but that's a separate issue. But if he's shown his commitment and he's lived here for his whole life or whatever it is, he's paying the right amount of money and filling out the right amount of forms and showing he's not affiliated with some sort of terrorist organization, then absolutely he should be able to get a documented worker status.
I think on the bright side, at least this guy has a non-embarrassing reason to tell his friends why he can't get a job at a law firm. Everybody else just makes up excuses. This guy's just like, well, I'm not a citizen.
Right, right. Very good. Well, with that, let's turn to the next news story. This one is – well, this is really in your sphere, your bailiwick, as they say, because it involves physical fitness.
First of all, I don't know that anybody says bailiwick, but go on.
All right, I'm going to let you set this one up, okay?
Okay. The Marine Corps instituted, I think about a year ago, but it was supposed to go into effect recently, new physical fitness standards for female Marines who now can actually fight in war. And one of the requirements was a minimum of 3 pull-ups. It was physical. Obviously, all of the armed forces have some kind of physical fitness standards. The Marines are known to be a very physically rigorous training program, right? And so women have to have a minimum of 3 pull-ups, which, by the way, is important to note that that's also the minimum for male candidates. And apparently, after this was instituted, almost no women were able to do 3 pull-ups, which is obviously a problem. And so they're pulling back on these standards and giving women the option to do either pull-ups or a flexed arm hang, which if any of you were in gym classes in the 80s and the 90s, I don't know if they still do it today, we had to do the physical fitness tests. Guys did pull-ups and girls did this ridiculous flexed arm hang where they just hung there for as long as they could as guys were sweating it out trying to do pull-ups. Did you have to do that, Alex?
No, we used to use medicine balls and Indian well, clubs.
I was going to say, after you killed a saber-toothed tiger, were you able to come in and...
Well, no, you know, we would be at the English Gentleman's Club, and we would have to do calisthenics and use medicine balls. And then we'd do everything really fast, like in black and white.
Yeah, with that crazy music in the background.
That's right, with the ragtime music in the back. No, look, I have to be honest. I am completely on board for women's rights for 100,000%. But in an issue where you're talking about life or death and ability to defend not only themselves but their fellow soldiers, I'm sorry. I think you have to adhere to certain standards. If you can't pull up your body weight more than 3 times and that's the standard that the military set for whatever reason they have, that's a problem. I mean,
yeah.
Theoretically, that standard has not been set out of just, you know, randomness. It's been set because – you could be hanging off a cliff in Afghanistan and you need to be able to pull your body weight up wearing, you know, 70 pounds of body armor.
Right. Or I could have gotten my leg blown off and you're the only person that can drag me back to the camp where my life could be saved. And because you can't do 3 pull-ups, you can't carry my body weight.
Right. Now, look, I'm not saying that because women are smaller physically, they shouldn't be in, because look, I'm a smaller guy. I'm 5'4", 140 pounds.
Can you do 3 pull-ups?
I probably can do 20.
Right. Well, then there you go. And what this really comes down to is this is just a physical fact that women don't have the same upper body strength as men, regardless of your size. I mean, you, Alex, you're a smaller guy. I'm a medium sized guy. I know, you know, bigger guys out there. there's, it has nothing to do with size. It has to do with the way men's musculature is built, is developed versus women. Women don't have the same shoulder and chest muscles and back muscles that men do.
Right.
Yes, and yes, and I know, I'm sure if some nutcase woman competitor, bodybuilder, weightlifter is listening to this, they're going to send me a tweet of saying that they can do 30. And yeah, there are exceptions.
No, but
typically, you take the average man and the average woman. The average man has significantly more upper body muscle and mass than a woman does.
But here's the thing. But here's the point. Three pull-ups is not that many. My sister, who is a very petite woman, 5 feet tall, 5 foot one, probably weighs 100 pounds, she can do 10 pull-ups in a row. Full pull-ups. Without a chair, without any kind of assist. She can do. She just works out a lot, and she's, you know, she's done triathlons or whatever else, but not all the time. And you know, she's in shape. And I think there's nothing wrong with the military, whether it's the Marines, the Army, whomever, saying to everybody, guys and women, look, there's certain minimum physical standards you have to be able to meet because the rigors of combat are such that
yep.
you have to, like Kevin said, you have to be able to drag your fellow soldier, God forbid, across the lines or pull yourself up off a cliff or out of a tank or whatever the hell it is. And three pull-ups is not that many. They're not saying 15. They're not saying run a mile in 5 minutes.
Yeah, and I think, and if that creates a smaller percentage of women that are capable of being combat soldiers, well, then that's just the result. But I know, you know, I have friends in the military, and you know, friends who served overseas, and everybody in the military will tell you, you're constantly counting on the guy next to you. It's not a solo thing. Your unit, your group is the is what you rely on. And if you can't, if you're looking at the person next to you going, I don't know if she could, you know, could carry me, or if we have to move some obstacle and is she going to be strong? Like, you don't want to have to deal with that. And it has nothing to do with being a man or a woman. I'm sure if I was sitting next to a little guy who I knew couldn't do it, I would be concerned the same way.
Well, and by the same token, I read an article recently that's saying that more and more of the recruits that the military gets are guys. Not women, guys are completely out of shape because they've grown up playing video games and sitting on the couch, and they're
right.
obese.
And that's terrible also.
Right, but I'm saying the point is these standards are not to be gender discriminatory. I think they're supposed to be like, look, there are physical realities of being in the military, at least in the combat world. And, you know, you have to be able to meet those minimum standards. And I think
listen, if Demi Moore could do a one-handed push-up with those fake boobs in G.I. Jane, I think anybody, any woman should be able to do that. And if you haven't seen G.I. Jane, I highly recommend seeing it.
Right. Now, look, I'm not a military person. I was never in the military. I actually applied to be in the JAG Corps, and I was rejected, which is a whole other ball of wax. I was rejected, but not because of anything substantive. That's a quick story. I applied to the JAG Corps very early on in my legal career, like literally shortly after law school. I sent in my application. I think it was to the Air Force or the Navy, one of the two. I think it was the Air Force. And I was going to apply to like all three branches or all four branches. And my picture, they had a place where you put a passport size photo in the upper right hand corner within a dotted line square. And I think my application came back as rejected because the photo I put in did not actually touch the dotted lines. It was slightly too small.
No.
Yeah. So when I got it back, I figured it was an omen from God saying, like, you're just not supposed to be in the military. And I never...
Oh, so you weren't rejected. Your application was just sent back, and you could have resubmitted it.
Well, I was rejected. My application was rejected on logistical grounds, but I figured that's it. I'm not doing it.
That was God, the hand of God coming down and saying, Alex, you do not belong.
That's right. But look, I obviously being – so I'm not here as an expert on the military, but – from what I've read and everything I've heard from people who've been in the military, obviously it's an incredibly demanding job, literally a life or death job in so many of its instances. And it seems to me, looking in from the outside, that, hey, you want people who are in great physical shape on the front lines. Bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is, you know, you have to be strong enough. You have to have, and just not physical strength, but mental strength. And it's, you know, I give credit to anybody who volunteers to put their lives up for this country.
That's a great point. But wait a second. Don't gloss over that. Mental strength, too, because, right, you don't want somebody who's nuts on the front line. Because what if they snap? I mean, you know, then you're going to say, well, the guy didn't pass his emotional stability test, but let's lower the standards. No, you'd never do that.
Right.
Because the first time a grenade goes off and the guy goes bananas,
exactly.
You know, it'd be chaos.
Exactly. No, you have to – there is a certain – recruit. They're looking for a certain, you know, archetype of a person that they want in there, and the military hierarchy knows better than we do what makes a soldier. And if they're saying that a soldier has to be able to do at least 3 pull-ups, which, like you said, is not a great amount of pull-ups.
No, there's plenty of women who can do 3 pull-ups, believe me. I'm
What's
sure.
What's that?
There's plenty of women who can do 3 pull-ups.
Oh, absolutely. You think Matt Ritter could do 3 pull-ups?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I'm going to abstain from this.
I think we should have a Comedians at Law pull-up contest.
Pull-up contest, okay.
We have women in our group. I wonder if any of them could do 3 pull-ups.
I bet you they can.
I bet Joan could do 3 pull-ups. I see Joan being a fireball.
Possibly.
Just from angst and rage.
Well, wait a second. But and by the way, to finish this discussion, you know, like I've just out of curiosity, I've looked at like the military websites and recruiting and so forth. So, for example, like you can't you're no longer eligible for the military if you're my age. Like you can't after the age of 35 or 36, you cannot apply for the military. So
that's right.
Here
and
I
that's
am.
A lot of the federal. I think that works for the FBI and the a lot of the different federal.
Right, but here I am, right? Like I can run, you know, 10 miles in like just over an hour. I can do 20 pull-ups. I can do 50 push-ups in a row. My health is startling good for a person my age, which is 46, and yet I'm ineligible to apply for the military if I wanted to because I'm 46.
And you're just a freak of nature. Listen, anybody who survives purely off of those whey, whatever those bars you eat, those dry, brittle. I mean, well, you'd be great in the military because they eat those MREs. You'd probably think that was a feast.
Right, but the point is, it's like some people, you just, if you don't meet certain standards, that's it. And, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's, you know, and the military definitely falls outside of the realms of, you know, typical hiring practices. They can discriminate in some ways, and I think a lot of it is incredibly necessary. So this is going to be. I think this is one of those things that hopefully they don't back up on, and they don't. I guess it's called gender norming, where I guess a woman could do 1.5 pull-ups or something to the man's 3, but I think that would be incredibly detrimental to the goal of the military.
Yeah.
So I think you're just. And by the way, I said that almost no women did it. Apparently, only 45% of the women met the minimum, which is considered basically a failure of the program.
Yeah.
So, but you know what? But then only 45% of the women in the military will be able to fight on the front lines. I'm sure they can do other stuff. But as far as putting themselves into combat situations, well, that's biology. That's how we're built.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get off the misogyny train here for a second. Let's go to the Twitter. We don't have an interview this week because
have one more story.
Oh, we do. I'm sorry. That's right.
This is, I think news wise nationally, this is our biggest story.
Okay.
Weed is now legal in Colorado.
That's true.
And that's going to be a very, very big deal. And it's already created, you know, national headlines and a national buzz about, the consequence and the impact of marijuana, you know, as a legal product. Apparently, I think in the first day of sales in Colorado, they sold $1 billion worth of marijuana.
How much? A billion?
A million. Okay. $1 million, which is still a lot of weed, and that was only from 35 dispensaries. So now, you know, obviously now, supporters of legal weed and the critics are coming out saying what the issues are going to be. I think to date there were 2 people arrested because they were smoking in public. Currently in Colorado, smoking in public is a misdemeanor that gets you. It's like a parking ticket. It gets you up to $150 fine. Obviously, no jail time or anything like that. But this is big. This is big. They're saying that it could create $67 million in revenue in the first year just in taxes alone. And that's significant, especially in a state like Colorado. I think half of that money roughly is going to go to building new schools and improving schools. And then the other half will just go into the general fund for the state. So that's a lot of revenue.
Right. And I think this could be
a really big deal. I know Washington State is on the cusp of a similar law that's not quite as lenient. In Colorado, you can grow up to 6 of your own plants. Washington is not allowing that. And there's a specific limit in Washington of how much can be produced annually. I think it's something like 45 metric tons. I might have made that number up. But this is a movement, and this is happening in our country. It's something that probably a lot of us never thought would happen. And I think this is a really good sign. I think this is a good thing, and I think it's something long time coming.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's literally a no-brainer to me because, look, I'm not saying there are no health risks of marijuana. There are certainly. It's a substance, and any substance you put in your body has health consequences. But the health consequences comparative to certain other substances that people use that are legal, such as alcohol, are relatively minor, especially when you compare equivalent volumes. It seems to me, yes, legalization with regulation, those two have to be coupled. But if you have legalization with regulation, the upside is huge because, as you say, the financial windfall to the states and to the federal government in terms of new tax revenues to appropriately channel are huge. Now, that's right. That's the key question. Are the legislatures and the executive branches of the states and the federal government gonna stand up and do the right thing and use these monies for the appropriate reasons, which is education, crime prevention, getting to kids early in life so that they don't be turned to life of crime, rehabilitating those who are already incarcerated for minor drug offenses, those kinds of things.
Well, and I think there's another real important component to the long-term effect of legalizing marijuana is that in my quick internet search just now, apparently 1 in 8 drug prisoners are behind bars for pot-related crimes. And prisoners in jail in America cost the system over $1 billion a year. That was a 2007 statistic, so I'm sure it's more now. So you're really cutting down on the crime rates and the potential for organized crime and violent crimes. And I just think the broad effects of this are really going to be, it's going to be positive. And I think the critics are going to lose a lot of footing. And between Colorado and Washington, and I think a couple other states are starting to mull it over. Once you start to see the positive effect of it, I think it's going to be hard to argue in any states.
Yeah, I mean, look, I agree with you. This is obviously we're not being too exciting for the audience because we're not arguing with one another. But I think my only caveat to all this was that there also has to be appropriate regulation, whether it's banning smoking marijuana outdoors or whether it's banning marijuana within a certain number of feet or yards of schools.
And Colorado did that. You can't smoke weed in any public facilities. I don't know about outside, but I think you have to be within your own property. So
right.
It seems to me
it should be relatively similar to the laws governing alcohol. Like you can't sell to minors, you can't smoke, you can't drink
right.
or smoke.
You have
in
to
your
be
schools.
21 to buy.
Right. All those things.
The money coming out of this. First of all, they're taxing the shit out of this.
Excuse me. We have
sorry.
A family-friendly podcast
sorry.
Here. Yes, they're taxing the stuffing out of it.
Yes. And it's I think it's between all the different taxes, the excise tax and the there's another state tax and everything. It works out to like a 37% tax on it. So the price there's a state excise tax of 15%. There's a special sales tax of 10%. A special so if you're in Denver, special Denver sales tax of 3.5%, plus the usual state and city taxes of more than 7%. That adds up to a lot of tax. I think they said the average cost of an eighth of an ounce of weed, which is I think the typical single purchase size, is $65. Now I spoke to some people who buy weed regularly here in New Jersey, and they say an eighth of an ounce costs anywhere from $40 to $50. So you're looking at, a roughly $20 markup, but you're also paying that actually $20 for the comfort of not having to worry about getting arrested.
Well, also knowing there's some quality control because it's not going to be laced with PCP or
right.
cut glass in there or put baby powder, whatever it is that people use to mess with or depurify weed.
Yeah.
And it's
probably like any industry. There's going to be competition to make the best product, the cleanest, most natural, most effective. I will admit on air that I, for one, have never smoked weed in my life. I probably never will. But I think I know a lot of people who do or have and still do, and I think this is the right thing to do. And I think we're going to see that a lot of the stigma and the wives' tales that went along with marijuana are going to be eradicated as people start to realize that this is no more harmful than having a beer.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, then. So I think let's turn to the Twitter feed, because we don't have an interview this week because with the new year, people weren't really available. But if you do want to be interviewed, particularly if you're involved with bar association activities or law school activities, we'd like to hear from you. You could tweet us at Comedians at Law. But let's go to the Twitter feed this week, Kev. We've got, as always, we're just killing it in terms of getting new followers.
We're populating, but we're not creating any more activity, and that always drives me crazy because I don't understand why people are following us, but they don't want to talk to us. Right. We're nice guys.
But just starting December 26th, which is roughly a week ago, Marita Coxwell followed us, and then we've got a bunch of new followers. I just had it here. Suki, Comedy Diaspora, Manning Smith, and then we've got Sarah Dane, Law School Digest, Allison Boyce. So we want to thank all of you for following us. Now what we'd like to see is you engaging with us via Twitter, telling us what you want to hear, what you don't like about what we're doing, whether you'd want us to come perform for you or your group, whether you think
and
Kevin is on...
And if tweet at us in Klingon, if you want. Shoot us a tweet. If somebody tweets at us in Klingon, I'll send you a t-shirt.
Let's go one better. If someone tweets at us in Klingon, verifiably Klingon, we'll send them a $10 gift card to Starbucks.
Ooh, there you go. I like that.
We're going to email them.
Wow, we're Comedians at Law is now offering up money.
Yeah, I'm that intrigued by this that I think if someone actually tweets us something in Klingon.
Yeah, we will send you a
$10. By the next podcast. It has to be within a week.
Within the next week, absolutely. It has to be Klingon. I'm sure there's some Klingon translator. And don't tell us what it is. Just tweet at us in Klingon. I don't know. I think Klingon might have
its own alphabet. No, come on. Let's not make this ridiculously hard for ourselves. They should send us a link to a Klingon translator so we can verify what they said is something that's actually Klingon.
All right. That's fair. Right. But yeah, tweet at us something in Klingon. Maybe tweet at us in Klingon how many pull-ups you can do and really work it all together. And while you're tweeting at us about how many pull-ups you can do, you should be smoking pot.
right.
Just to work all of our topics together.
All right. Okay, I like that. All right. Well, that was episode 67 of the podcast. I'm Alex Barnett.
I'm Kevin Israel.
And we will see you next, or speak to you next week.